Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
And about... Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content. But you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thank you so much for being with us today. We talk about Father Junipero Serra, I've been lately calling him the St. Patrick of California, but we'll find out from our guest today whether that's an appropriate analogy. Among the many statues that are coming down or being attacked or being relocated or causing anxiety in city councils around California are the statues of St. Junipero Serra these days. In part, this is a period of, you could say reevaluation, I suppose, if you wanted to be generous, but I think also the word mania might apply to some of what's going on in the attack on statues. But it has to do with wanting to maybe purify the memory and purify our public spaces of some figures who there has not been adequate critique of. One wonders whether Serra fits in that category, however, so we invited, and we're very delighted that he took our invitation, the author of one of the finest books you will ever see about early California and Father Junipero Serra. Our guest today is Dr. Robert Senkiewicz. He is a scholar at Santa Clara University, a Jesuit institution near San Jose, and with his wife, Rosemarie Beebe, he is author of several books, including Junipero Serra, California Indians and the Transformation of a Missionary. I hope I got all that right. Dr. Senkiewicz, thank you for being with us.
You did. Thank you, Cy. It's very nice to be here.
Well, we have discussed before this conversation, that it would be great for us if you could just fill us in on who this man is. That seems to be... Well, maybe that doesn't matter anymore to people who the person is, but it should matter. At the very least, it should matter. So we'll have that discussion. But if I could start before we get into meeting the man, Junipero Serra, what is your sense as you see city councils voting to move statues of Father Serra, people even tearing down statues of Father Serra? What's your emotional reaction to that as a scholar of Father Serra?
My reaction is that the people who are engaged in this activity generally have an incomplete view of who Father Serra was and what he attempted to do. They don't really understand the context of the California missions, and they don't understand the context of Spanish and Mexican California, you know, the way that California was before the gold rush.
Yeah.
And so Father Serra was, you know, for a variety of reasons, and I'm sure we can talk about them as we go on, but for a variety of reasons, Father Serra became, in the late 19th and early 20th century, he became kind of a symbol in the Anglo understanding of California, of everything that happened in California before the gold rush.
Okay, so he's the guy that sums it up.
He's the guy that sums up, and that's not accurate. But what happened, It's at those points that a lot of the statues of Sarah, not the ones that are currently at a lot of the missions, but a lot of the public statues, the one in Golden Gate Park, one in Monterey, that they were put up, and they were put up during a period that was called the Spanish Revival period, late 19th, early 20th century, where California's Spanishness became kind of an important part of California's self-understanding. And in that movement, Sarah became kind of the overarching symbol of that age. Now that was not correct. So this, a lot of the statues that are being, you know, foregrounded right now were not put up with a full understanding of who Sarah was. And similarly, the people who are taking down the statues don't have a full understanding, it seems to me, of what Sarah who he actually was and what he actually did either.
So it almost seems as if the people during that Spanish Revival period, they wanted to promote Sarah. They weren't trying to denigrate the man Sarah, but they were promoting him as kind of a symbol for the whole thing that happened to California. You go ahead.
Yeah, what happened, it's kind of interesting, you know, what happens is that in the mid-1880s, the railroad reaches Los Angeles directly from the Midwest, the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, and there's a huge influx of people, you know, from the Midwest and from parts of the United States into Southern California, and that's when the kind of the Anglo settlement of Southern California really takes off. And, you know, as more people get in there, what happens when people settle in an area, they want to find out more about it, and they want to kind of understand something about it, and they want to kind of promote it in some way or other. And so the people in Southern California who are trying to promote Southern California, you know, so what are you, part of a promotion is always kind of, you know, the founding of this area, kind of a founding story or almost a founding mythology.
Yes.
And, you know, in California at the time, San Francisco, which was the major population center at the time, you know, San Francisco had the gold rush all locked up. So that was it, you know. So the people in Southern California, what were they attracted to? They were attracted to the landscape. And part of the landscape were the missions, which were a condition of disrepair at the time. And so what you get is that people kind of glom onto the pre-U.S. part of California as their founding mythology. And, you know, people like Charles Lummis and Helen Hunt Jackson, who wrote the very popular novel Ramona,
yeah.
They create kind of a romantic view of Spanish California. The Mexican part is usually ignored, but Spanish California, they create a kind of a very romantic view of it, where you have, as part of this romantic view, you have selfless, heroic missionaries, happy, contented Indians, ranchos that have fandangos all the time, you know, yeah. That kind of thing. And so what you get is you get this notion of kind of a golden, idyllic golden age, which never existed in that way, right, as part of Southern California's identity, you know, and that eventually becomes kind of California's identity. You know, I grew up in New York myself,
yeah.
And when I came out to California, to go to graduate school, you know, one thing which struck me right away was, you know, like Safeways looked like missions, you know.
They look more like the missions than the missions do.
They have tile roofs and everything like,
yeah,
that. You
right.
Know? I learned to understand that the Spanishness was an important part of California's
right.
popular identity. Well, in this Spanishness, the only person who had a biography written about him or her, who lived in California during that period, was Sarah. You know, a couple of years after he died, his close friend and colleague, Francisco Palou, published in Mexico City a very heroic biography of Sarah. So as the only one that had a biography, he becomes kind of a symbol. And he becomes the symbol of this kind of romanticized, idyllic picture of Southern California.
And you
so
miss,
what happened? Go ahead.
You miss something very that's really key to the identity of the man when you make him this symbol of idyllic, pastoral, early
sure.
California, because you miss his struggle against the. Really, various attacks on the Indian people, that you miss the fact
yeah,
that he
yeah.
he it wasn't idyllic, yeah. but he was on the side of the Indian people.
You know, but it was kind of, you know, one of the things to understand about California before the gold rush is that, you know, California was not part of North America like we understand North America now. California was part of Latin America. And to understand what the missions were, you don't look at what was happening along the east coast of the United States. You look at what was happening in Mexico and in other parts of Latin America. And from a very early period, relating, you know, all the way back to the early 1500s, to the writings of Bartolome de las Casas, who was a Dominican a missionary who was savagely attacked to the way that the Spanish conquistadors were treating the native peoples. Part of the missionary self-identity and what they understood themselves doing was protecting Indians from oppression.
Yes.
Protecting the indigenous people from being savagely oppressed or working in the haciendas or in the silver mines by the conquistadors and by the colonial vice regal authorities, you know. And so when Sarah decides to come over to the New World at the end of the 1730s, you know, when he decides to come over there, you know, for his 1740s, it's very much he regards himself as part of that tradition. You know, the job of the missionary, besides converting the people, is to protect them from the ravages of the colonial authorities. Now, that, you know, nothing is ever simple in history, you know, but Sarah himself, you know, was part of that colonial system. I mean, there's, you know, in New Spain, in Latin America, the missionaries were paid by the government, you know, and so they were part of that system. But, you know, the system is not some, you know, a univocal system. It had people within it who were more favorable to the indigenous people and people who were less favorable to the indigenous people. And in that spectrum, Sarah and the missionaries, most of the missionaries, were very much on the side of the indigenous people.
So in the middle of the 1700s, for a Spaniard of the kind of life that Father Sarah was living, he's from Mallorca, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And he's a very well educated person. He's kind of a professor, really. He's a professorial person, right?
He was. He was one of the most eminent people on the island of Mallorca. He was a very well-known professor of philosophy and theology at the Lulian University, which was the Franciscan University in Palma, in Mallorca. And he was a very, very well-known kind of thing, you know. And at some point, you know, Rosemary and I, when we were doing our biography, we tried to, you know, try to find any writings that Sarah might have left behind about why he decided to become a missionary, and there really aren't any. But our sense is that, you know, so there he is. He's a very well-situated, well-known, successful guy, you know, in Mallorca. And at some point, I think he kind of says, you know, is this why I became a priest? You know, is this all there is?
Right.
And, you know, so in Mallorca, one of the most famous members of the Franciscan community was a guy named Ramon Llull, who had been a member of the Third Order of St. Francis, who had gone to North Africa to preach to the Muslims, you know, in the Franciscan tradition. St. Francis himself had gone to Egypt,
right,
you know, to deal with the Sultan in Egypt. And so missionary activity was a very, very important part of the Franciscan tradition. And it makes sense to us as we were studying Father Sarah that, you know, if he's kind of having a, not an identity crisis or anything like that, but if he's wondering, what else can I do?
Yeah.
As a Franciscan, being a missionary is one of the things that in Mallorca, which is on a lot of trade routes, you know, it's a seaport place, you know, going across the seas is going to be an important part of that, renewing himself as a Franciscan. So when he decides to do that and become a missionary, he joins this 250-year-old tradition of Spanish missionaries, and our job our job is a number of things: to convert the native peoples, to make them productive citizens of the Spanish Empire, and to protect them from the ravages of the colonial authorities.
And so he comes then to Mexico, and and this is a change of life for him. This is not a this is not a self-promoting move. He comes to Mexico, but his intention is to teach here in Mexico as well.
Well, his intention is, you know, so he goes to he lands at Veracruz, and interestingly enough, he decides to walk from Veracruz to Mexico City, and during that walk, he gets infected, and he has a limp for the rest of his life. But he gets to Mexico City on December 31st, 1749. He's at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, you know, which is a very significant shrine, you know, the indigenous version of the Blessed Virgin. And on January 1st, 1850, he ends up at the Franciscan missionary headquarters in Mexico City. 6 months later, he's in the missions. He's in the missions in Mexico.
So walking, first of all, the walking from Veracruz, he doesn't have to walk. Is this a kind of Catholic penance type of thing that he's doing?
What he's trying to do. Actually, Palou, who was with them, you know, and you know, they were on that boat about a couple of dozen potential, you know, missionaries, Franciscans and Dominicans, and all except Sarah and one other person, you know, they get on wagons and they ride to Mexico City, which is the normal thing to do. But what he wanted to do was he really wanted to prepare himself for the hardships that that he was going to experiencing as a missionary, to toughen himself and to do penance for his own sinfulness, which he was always very conscious of. So he decided to walk, and this was a penance, but it was an unusual penance,
and it cost him. So for the rest of his life, he has this leg infection.
He had this limp, right? So and it periodically flares up.
When you say 6 months later, then he's in the missions, but not in what we think of as California. Where does he go?
No. Interestingly enough, Sarah comes to Mexico in 1750. And he dies in 1784, so that's 34 years. He spends a majority of the time that he's in America not in California. He spends it in Mexico and Baja California. He has a whole career. He spends 8 years in an area about 200 miles north of Mexico City, slightly north of the city of Querétaro, in an area called the Sierra Gorda, which was an already existing Franciscan mission. He's ministering to the Pame people there. He spends 8 years there, he and Palou, and for three of those years, he's the mission superior there. He lives in a village called Jalpan, and the church that he was stationed in is still there. In fact, when he was canonized by Pope Francis a few years ago, there was a huge celebration in the Sierra Gorda, celebrating his canonization. And then, you know, it's kind of interesting, because then what happens is that he suddenly recalled to Mexico City, and he's told by his superiors that he and Palou, who was his former student and his close friend, were going to go to Texas, because the Comanche Indians had destroyed a mission in Texas at San Saba, about 200 miles north of San Antonio. And as soon as the Spanish army would regain control, he and Palou were going to go replace the missionaries who had been killed there.
Okay.
Well,
wow.
The Spanish army never regained control, so he was not sent to Texas. So he spent the next 8 years. So it's 8 years in the Sierra Gorda. Then they spent the next 8 years basically at San Fernando in Mexico City, the Franciscan missionary headquarters, but also going around a number of villages in Mexico. He's a member of, you know, what we would call nowadays the mission band. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a group of Franciscans. I remember when I grew up in New York in my parish at St. Columba on West 25th Street in Manhattan, you know, every couple of years we would have a mission. We'd have these priests come in and they would preach, and there'd be benedictions and processions and confessions and all of this kind of thing. And they were trying to, you know, revivify the fervor of the parish.
Right.
Well, that's what he was doing. He was a member of a group of Franciscans who would go around and basically, you know, they would do processions, they would preach, they would ask members of parishes to repent, you know, become more fervent Christians. So he did that in, you know, big cities and in little villages. He preached in Oaxaca, which is now a big city, but then he preached in a number of fairly small places along the Gulf of Mexico and in that area. And in that, it's very interesting, he gets a really good sense of popular Mexican religion, you know, among the right. among the indigenous people in Mexico. You know, and popular Mexican piety is, as you know, we know, it's a mix of traditional pre-Christian piety and Christian piety, and it's all kind of mixed up. And Our Lady of Guadalupe is a great example of that. You know, she is an indigenous virgin. You know,
yeah.
So it's kind of so he gets it by the time that, and so he does that for 8 years. And then what happens is that the Spanish monarch, Charles III, expels the Jesuits from Spain and the Spanish Empire for a variety of reasons. And Sarah is, so the Franciscan's going to pick up the Jesuit missions in Baja California. Sarah is sent to Baja California, and he's there for 2 years. He's the head of the Franciscan missions there. And then when Spain decides to move up from Baja California to Upper California or Alta California, he is asked if he wants to go, and he jumps at the opportunity. And so in 1769, he comes up.
And then comes right here to where we are in San Diego.
In San Diego, exactly. San Diego had been discovered a number of a century and a half earlier, and it was the Spanish wanted to come up here because they were afraid that the Russians, who were moving across Alaska, were going to come down.
Yeah.
And so what they wanted to do was they wanted to get here before the Russians could get here, and based upon the experience of early explorers, the expedition, which was headed by Gaspar de Portola, was told to occupy two places, occupy San Diego and Monterey, because those were two bays
yeah.
that had been discovered by earlier explorers. So they get to San Diego in 1769 and to Monterey in 1770. And Sarah founds missions at both places, the first one being in San Diego and the second one being at Monterey.
So when he comes to a place like San Diego or Monterey, what does he come as part of? Well, first of all, I want to ask you, how did he get here? Did he continue this penance of walking everywhere?
No, he didn't. I mean, there is a legend that that after he got to Mexico, he never rode a mule again. No, we can see from his diary that he did that. I mean, he would walk occasionally, but I mean, you know, if he would, he's with an expedition. Portola, you know, has got 30 or 40 soldiers.
Okay.
A bunch of Baja California Indians, you know, and if Sarah figured he was going to walk, Portola wouldn't have let him because he would have just slowed everything up, you know. So he rode up, you know, he rode.
So in his group there's these 30 or so Spanish soldiers. There's mm-hmm. there's native people from Baja California that came up.
Right.
And what's mm-hmm. the why are they coming to found a town or?
No, they're coming. Basically, what their job is to take care of the to escort the Spanish expedition through this territory of Baja California. You know, there are different indigenous groups farther north. Some of them do stay in Alta California. A good number of them return to Baja California, and some of them die on the road as well. No Spanish soldiers, or you know, most of the soldiers were actually soldiers from Baja California. In all of California, you know, even though you know the popular picture is that it was Spanish California, most of the people were Mexicans, and they were mestizos and you know the typical what you would get for Mexican soldiers. Yeah,
right.
So there were soldiers. And there were missionaries, and you know, by this time, the person who was in charge of the whole expedition, who was a Spanish official who had been sent over, Jose de Galvez, he decided that you needed both soldiers and missionaries to kind of get this thing done as fast as possible.
So that's the idea, is that there is a question of expediency, because they want to establish a kind of Spanish society, and because there's the Russians coming down from the north.
The Russians are coming.
Okay. So what does he do? I mean, like, I don't know what a missionary does when he gets here.
Yeah, and see, it's very interesting because with Sarah, and you can see this especially when he gets to when they get to San Diego. Portola's object is, sorry, I found San Diego, and the next thing I do is find Monterey, and then I want to get out of here. I want to get back to civilization. Portola only stayed here, you know, a small amount of time. He wanted to get back to Mexico City. So Sarah and basically a number of just a few soldiers and a couple of missionaries are in San Diego when Portola is off trying to find Monterey. And so he founds at the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross on June 14th, he founds Mission San Diego. And everything, you know, the mission and the Presidio are very close to each other. There's actually an attack. In the middle of August, local Kumeyaay people attack the mission. A couple of people are killed. And when Portola returns, having unsuccessfully looked for Monterey and having accidentally discovered this huge body of water that nobody had ever heard of before called San Francisco Bay, they manage to stay there. Sarah doesn't do any doesn't perform any baptisms there. He gets to Monterey. And they found the Presidio. And if you know Monterey, the Presidio is where, you know, the customs house is and, you know, Church Street and things like that. And they found the Presidio in June of 1770. But Sarah is immediately says to himself, and he writes back to Mexico City to his superior, hey, this is not the place for a mission. And the reason was very simple. There were no native communities around. You know, the indigenous people were not living in the top of Monterey Bay. They were living, you know, where anybody with any sense would live. You know, they were living along the Carmel River in the Carmel Valley, you know. And so Sarah wanted to move the mission closer to where the native people were, because his notion was that we want to kind of establish a presence there, and their curiosity will be such that they will kind of come and see, and gradually we can attract some of them into this community. But it was a slow kind of process, and he wanted it to be slow. He did not want to force people into the mission system. He wanted them to come and see and to kind of experience a Christian community. And in doing that, he thought that eventually some of them would be attracted to the mission system.
I think that's
so
important.
He wanted the mission to be close to the people, close to the indigenous people.
It's very important what you're saying, because this sense of people came and forced people to be Christians is really not true. And it's generally not true. As a matter of fact, across the entirety of wherever Spain went in the Americas, baptism is a voluntary choice. There has to be an invitation, and there wasn't a sense of conversion by the sword anywhere, really.
There was, you know, there were a few instances later on when there were expeditions that were kind of sent out, but that was more the exception than the rule. The problem with most people who come in to the mission system are not forcibly brought in. The overwhelming majority come in because, well, you know, for a variety of reasons, and, you know, we don't really know, you know, why they all came in, but it's pretty clear that, with the Spanish coming in, you know, the soldiers, and they bring sheep and goats and everything like that, you know, and what happens is that the indigenous way of living, you know, which is basically these people get their fruits and berries and some game and things like that. Well, what happens is that the Spanish presence, you know, the sheep and the goats and the cattle are kind of trampling on the fruits and the berries, and they're chasing away the game, you know, and the Spanish, the soldiers, when they set up the Presidio, they're changing the landscape. And so often enough, what happens is that people, you know, that they tend to kind of be more attracted to the missions because their traditional sustenance is gone. You know, their traditional landscape, which has sustained them for centuries, is all of a sudden no longer there. And whatever else the mission has, it has food. And also the Spanish, you know, they're bringing as has happened, you know, wherever Europeans came to any part of the New World, they're bringing diseases that people did not have an immunity to.
Right.
And so, you know, when the traditional medical people in the Indian village were unable to do something, when my kid was sick, well, I'll try the priest. You know, so they would sometimes. So the combination of the changes in the landscape and the spread of diseases for which people did not have immunity meant that people were, in a number of cases, more willing to give the missions a shot because at least, you know, that's something that is there.
But Sarah's plan is basically set up house, and then as people come by, then share.
That was his that was very much his original plan, and that was the plan that basically was founded at a number, you know, that he used to found his missions, you know, after San Diego and well, he was never really at San Diego anymore than after he left there, but they founded San Antonio, which was, you know, off of the road near now what's King City, off of Highway 101, and they founded San Gabriel, they founded San Luis Obispo, and he basically had the same, you know, he wasn't present for all of these, but the earliest group of missionaries followed as much as they could. They followed this particular way of trying to do things, setting up the missions by attracting people into them.
And over time, as you said, for a whole complex variety of reasons, that does prove successful. He is successful as a missionary.
There are probably a number of few thousand people who were baptized during Father Sarah's tenure, and he founds about six or seven missions. The changes for him in 1775, when there's a big revolt against and the Mission San Diego is destroyed in 1775, and one of his very, very close friends, Father Luis Jaime, another Mallorcan, was killed in that attack. Interestingly enough, Sarah, after he finds out about Father Jaime's death, writes a letter to the viceroy and says, you know, I've never really told you this, but if Indians kill me, if I'm killed by any native people, I don't want them punished. I want them forgiven, because to punish them is not why we came here. And I think that's one of the most personal letters that that Rosemary and I found when we were looking at his correspondence, you know, this kind of plea that if I'm killed, I could be killed. Right. My Father Jaime was killed. If I'm killed, I don't want the people who killed me to be punished. I want them to be forgiven, because the reason we came here is to show them God's love, not God's wrath.
That gives you a sense that the fact that he's now saint, he was made or elevated to the status of saint by Pope Francis. It gives you a sense, perhaps, and I want to get this from you, that he really was actually a saintly person, that this is not just propaganda or anything on the part of the church, that this, when you get to the man himself, he's tremendously patient, self-giving, forgiving, and saintly.
Yeah, and then, you know, and he's not—he wasn't perfect. I mean, you know, he had a temper, right? And when some of his fellow missionaries did things that he didn't like, boy, they found out about it. But you know, when Sarah was canonized, you know, I got a lot of questions, you know, and from people in the news media, and I kept saying over and over again, you know, when the church canonizes somebody, that doesn't mean they're saying he was perfect. This person was perfect. Else St. Peter would never have been canonized, you know.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, but they're saying that his virtues were at this time virtues that the church wants to put in front of the faithful. And, you know, there's a great picture that I use when Rosemary and I give talks about Father Sarah, and it's a mass in Rome at the North American College when the Pope came over and celebrated a mass when they were having a seminar on Sarah. And it's a picture of the Pope and Archbishop Gomez from Los Angeles giving the Pope a relic of Sarah, which the Pope is venerating. And I tell my students, I say, look at this picture. It's the most important thing about this picture is that the two men in this picture were both born in Latin America. you know,
yeah,
the Pope
that's
is
right.
from Argentina, and Archbishop Gomez was born in Mexico.
Right.
And, you know, you have to understand that in Latin America, you know, the way of treating the indigenous people is very different than you're used to, than you learned when you were going to grammar school and high school and you were studying the British Empire. You know, the British Empire, and then unfortunately the United States picked it up. You know, what's their policy towards the native peoples?
Move
push
them and
them
kill
away.
Them.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, and the Spanish Empire, for all of its faults, had tried to create a place for the indigenous people in, you know, in their society. It was an inferior place, to be sure, but it was a place, you know. And I always say, you know, you will never find any California missionary saying anything even remotely close to, you know, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, like you find said constantly in the United States westward movement.
Right, you know? But this is another thing that Father Sarah gets caught up in, is this, the idea that white Europeans treated the Native American people in a certain way. Well, much of that is true, but it's the way that the English treated Native people is very different from the way the Spanish did.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's not to say that there wasn't coercion and there wasn't violence.
Sure.
All you have to do is read Las Casas and read read Sarah. I mean, he's constantly, you know, he actually went down to Mexico City in 1773, took a trip down to Mexico City to try to get, and successfully he got an audience with the viceroy, and he got the military commander of California removed because he said he was treating the Indians too poorly. You know, oppressively, and he got him removed. So he did that. You know, and on the other hand, it's true that the missions were part of a colonial system. There was coercion, there was force. That kind of thing tended to happen after Sarah's death, and people, you know, this is where what we talked about in the beginning. He kind of becomes the symbol of everything that happened, and what happened, you know, after in the early decades of the 19th century. When the Mexican independence movement breaks out and there's guerrilla warfare, you know, with Father, you know, Hidalgo and Morelos and people like that, what happens is that, you know, the viceroy and the colonial authorities have a lot more important things to worry about than sending supply ships up to California. And so what happens is that supply ships basically stop, and all of a sudden the only institutions in California that are growing food and provisions are the missions. And so they become much more powerful and popular. And then, you know, some of the missionaries at that time, to keep the production going and everything like that, some of the recruitment efforts become much more harsh. And so that's when some of the native peoples are brought forcibly into the missions. And that's where, you know, they tend to go out farther and farther looking for people in the Central Valley and things like that. But that's well after Sarah left. And that's a method that he definitely would not have approved of.
So let me just remind the listener, we're speaking with Dr. Robert Senkiewicz, a scholar here in California of a great deal of California history. And he and his wife, Rosemarie Beebe, have a really majestic book, comprehensive, really, look at Father Junipero Serra. It's called Junipero Serra, California, Indians and the Transformation of a Missionary. Maybe before we go, if I may, Dr. Senkiewicz, if you could give me a sense of what that means, transformation of a missionary. What are you getting at?
What I'm getting at is that, you know, Sarah was, as we talked about at the beginning, when he came over to Mexico, he was an academic. He said he was an expert. He was an expert in the theology and philosophy of John Duns Scotus, you know, who was a very, very important Franciscan missionary, who's actually, you know, who laid the groundwork for the Vatican's eventual a declaration that the Immaculate Conception was a doctorine, you know, hundreds of years later.
He's a theologian and a philosopher, yeah, Duns Scotus.
Exactly. And so was Sarah. And when he comes over, and he, especially when he's in the Sierra Gorda, when, like we talked about it, when he's in Mexico, the 16 years that he spent in Mexico, he really understands that there is more to Christianity than philosophy and theology, which is not to denigrate that. But you know, what worked in Mallorca is not going to work here. And he tries as much as he can, you know, and he does this imperfectly, but he tries to become a missionary. And when you are a missionary, what do you have to do? You have to kind of try to understand the beliefs and the cultures and the folkways of the people you're trying to evangelize. You know, you don't come in and say, hey, I want to talk to you about the Immaculate Conception. They have no idea what you're talking about. You try to understand their culture, their religion, their spirituality, and you try to use that as a bridge into evangelization, you know. And so that's the that's how he was transformed. He became not a European academic, but he became a New World missionary trying to understand them. We have letters of him trying, you know, talking to the indigenous people, trying to understand their spirituality and how they looked at the world.
This idea of evangelizing, though, has lost its allure in many ways as we've become kind of multicultural and postmodern and all of that. It's hard for us, I think, to accept the truth about the man, that he really wanted every person to have contact with Jesus Christ. That's by sharing Jesus Christ, then he ennobles every life that comes in contact with Christ is a life that's ennobled and made whole. And so that I think even that now people would look on it and say, oh, well, you know, they just wanted to impose their religion on other people. It's not an imposition as far as he understands it. He doesn't want to take away what people have. He just wants them to know that God came in the person of Jesus.
Right. And you know, at its best, California missionaries tried to create a kind of Christianity that the indigenous people of California could really understand. There's a wonderful picture of the Archangel Raphael at Mission Santa Ynez. And the Archangel is a Chumash Indian. You know, there's a great pictures of the Stations of the Cross at Mission San Fernando, which were painted there, and it's very clear that the Roman soldiers who are crucifying Jesus are Spanish soldiers, and the women who are comforting Jesus are indigenous people. You know, so they're really trying to create a kind of Christianity that is specific to this particular type of culture. That's the transformation.
Once again, the book is called Junipero Serra, California Indians and the Transformation of a Missionary. One of the authors is our guest, Dr. Robert Senkiewicz. The other is his wife, Rosemarie Beebe. Thank you very much, Dr. Senkiewicz. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, so did I, Si. Thank you very much, and keep up your wonderful work.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you to everybody who joins us here on Catholic Answers Focus. We'd love it when you do, and if you would be so kind, wherever you get your podcast, if you would give us a review and maybe hit that little 5-star button. That helps to grow the podcast, and we want to grow it. We want more and more people to find it. If you are able and would like to support this podcast financially, you can just go to our website, givecatholic.com, and make your support there. Once again, I am Si Kellett, your host. We're very delighted that you joined us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.
These are unprecedented times for our world, our nation, and our faith. Cities are being burned, the debate rages over our national identity, and a global pandemic has shut down our parishes and deprived the faithful of the sacraments. Times like these can challenge our faith and our hope. Now more than ever, Catholics need to utilize technological advances to strengthen their faith. Endorsed by faithful bishops and cardinals, Breadbox Media is answering this need by providing on-demand podcasting that is faithful to the magisterial teachings of the Catholic Church. Our podcasts let you nurture your faith at any location, at your convenience, and at no cost. We are able to provide this free service because of the generosity of our donors. Would you consider giving a donation today to support this vital ministry? Not only is your donation tax deductible, but you will be helping to transform hearts, minds, and our culture for Christ. Donations can be made by going to breadboxmedia.com. Thank you, and may God bless you.